Welcome to the Beekeeper's Corner Podcast. BK Corner, Episode 11, The Heat is On. Hey everyone, Kevin England here, and I'd like to welcome you to our little BK Corner Fireside Chat. Pour out a steaming mug of hot cocoa and put on the earmuffs as we're ready to spend some time talking about keeping our little friends warm. It is December and the bees are bedded down for the winter. Not much to do out in the bee yard, so there should be a little time for increasing our bee know-how this winter. Glad you're here for the ride. It's an interesting conversation this go-round as we explore what's happening inside the hive when the thermometer goes down. I've got some additional thoughts on the long hive concept that I spoke of in our last episode, and I have some to share on the effectiveness of powdered sugar in mites. Let's just say don't waste it all by dusting that pound cake for the holidays. And speaking of cake, we'll tell you about the unlikely place for this episode's recipe, a soft honey cake. Last but not least, sometimes the simplest things are the hardest to come by. A little tip for hive management to finish the show. First, let's fire off on the local hive report. The hives are dormant for the winter and the chill is in the air here in New Jersey. It's been between 25 and 35 degrees every night here in the Northeast, and our highs have dipped below the 50s during the day as we roll into December. I've peeked in on our bees every once in a while, but I'm leaving everything buttoned up and don't intend to crack any of the seals on the hives until weather warms up around here. I've seen some remnants of paper at the hive entrances, the last vestiges of pollen patties that we provided to them before the hives were closed up for good. On three or four occasions that I've stepped out to look over our two hives, there have been bees flying around as low as 40 to 50 degrees. A venturous girl or two will take flight, and they seem to return rather quickly, assuming they are cleansing flights. On one occasion, I saw a drone discarded at the entrance, and the guards have peeked out at me from behind the mouse guard. I can only guess that things seem to be in order. The other day, I was standing at hive number two, didn't see any bees, just tapped on the hive a couple times, and there were about six or eight bees right at the entrance. I stepped away, and I assumed they went right back in. They didn't even come out. They just kind of went back in to manage their business inside. So that is it for the local hive report. Going to be pretty sparse here until the weather warms up and we get to see what's going on. We'll jump right into segment number one here. The question is, how do bees overwinter? As a novice beekeeper that is always trying to understand bees, my desire is to learn what I need to know in order to give our bees the best chance of survival. Over the past few seasons, our bees have been left to their own devices to survive winter's harsh realities with no help from us. To my amazement, the bees emerge in the spring, and I just can't help wonder how that works. So off to the internet for some research, and here's a primer on what I have to share. There are many studies on the internet about how bees survive over the winter. I'm going to pull one that talks about measuring temperatures inside the hive over an extended period. Also, how does the hive box protect the cluster? Not very well, it seems. A comparison between the common hive design and the hive that nature intended, the simple tree, is another study that I found. And all is well and good about temperatures and all this other thing, but how do the bees physically, mechanically, keep the heat in the cluster? I've got some information about that too. So let's start with The Thermology of Wintering Honeybee Colonies by Charles D. Owens. Published in 1971, this paper is available at the USDA website. It's the result of the study that is based on 1,200,000 temperature readings made from 1,600 to 2,000 thermocouple installations. Basically, they wired this hive or hives over a period of 5 years and took temperature readings through the fluctuations of a mist of a Wisconsin winter. The study was conducted in Madison, Wisconsin, and all the hives in this study were three hive bodies high. That means three boxes stacked on top of each other, said better. The study hive had a top and a bottom entrance It used three different conditions. A check hive, which was the regular configuration, just as you would buy it from the store. An insulated hive, what they called a packed colony, one that had thermal insulation wrapped around it, tar paper, and some sort of rooftop. And then one with a tape heater installed. And their goal was, over a five-year period, to see how the bees adapted to the different temperature conditions when they were left au naturel, when they were protected by some form of insulation, and when the beehive was actually heated. Now, the colonies were arranged in the center body of the hive to start. Remember that I said there were three bodies for this setup. And the top body had winter honey supply put in the top of it. So it's almost like a two-box configuration with a spare box down the bottom. So some base assumptions, as you would expect, warmth within the cluster permits the normal cluster activity, such as rearing of the young and consuming food. Without the warmth in the middle of the cluster, they're not going to survive. And I'll share some of the data, but I'm not going to be fastidious about it. There's a lot of data if you're interested in the study. I will publish it in the show notes, and it's a good time to let you know what they are. You can go get the information about this episode at www.bkcorner.org. And should you have any questions, jot me off an email at kevin@bkcorner.org. So I might generalize here and there and maybe might even misinterpret some of this data. But for the most part, I'm confident that I have it right. And there it is. So when you start reading through analytical data and looking at charts and graphs and talking scientific terms, it gets really challenging for the layperson. But for the most part, you can get the gist of what's going on. So some of the findings I thought were interesting and things that were important to the topic at hand. The seasonal changes in the cluster and the effects of the sun on the cluster. So what I didn't realize is that within certain temperature parameters, the cluster moved to different locations based on the sun radiation. The cluster generally moved to the south and slightly west of the hive center. And mind you, the beehives were situated, so they were facing the predominant sun direction, which is the southeast. The bees would move actually towards the edge of the box that was receiving the radiant heat. A tightness on the cluster corresponds to the temperature inside of the hive. At one point, they killed a study colony of bees and took it apart to measure it for heat and positioning. They introduced cyanide gas and basically, wrong term, but froze the hive in its state and then quickly took measurements. The findings were this. The temperature outside of the hive when they did this was 7 degrees. The temperature in the hive ranged from 14 to 94 in the cluster. So it was 14 degrees atmosphere inside the hive and 94 at the warmest part inside. The outer bees were formed in an insulating shell that prevents the excess loss of heat, and the outermost bees were facing inward, and the temperature was taken at the outer edge of the abdomen of the bees, and the temperature on the outside was 44 degrees Fahrenheit. So, better said, they're in a cluster, they're in a ball, the bees are facing inward, the abdomens are sticking out, and the thing that's the coldest is obviously the outside perimeter, which is the abdomen of the bee, and when they measured that, it was 44 degrees. So, 7 degrees outside, the temperature inside the hive was 14 degrees, and the temperature at the edge of the cluster was 44. The bees were densest, meaning packed tightly, just inside the outer edge, and the temperature there was at 55 to 56 degrees. Some of the bees were in empty cells in the comb, and other as close as they could be together in the interspaces between the comb. The inside cluster temperatures were recorded at 92 to 94 degrees where the brood was present. The temperature between the two frames of brood is normally 92 to 97 degrees. That's an interesting concept. So it's 44 at the outside, it's 92 to 94 in the middle, and it's 55 to 56 Well, when I say in the middle, in the heart of the cluster, and then between the two, it's 55 to 56 degrees. The area within the cluster that is 76 degrees is the active or heat-generating area and has the lower density of bees. So somewhere between the center of the mass, if you think about like the Earth and its core and its mantle, somewhere between the core and the mantle, the most temperature is being generated, and it's where the bees are at 76 degrees. Okay, interesting. You can kind of picture how it all plays out. The regular unprotected hive maintained the tighter cluster for heat control, and the cluster was often more centered in the hive as opposed to the other hive conditions with the insulation and the heater. So a standard run-of-the-mill hive, no insulation, just wood pine box. They're in the center of the hive more and away from the outside edges. The brood patterns maintained were the smallest in the conventional hive, and I guess that stands to reason because they weren't as warm. The unprotected hive cluster did not move to the sun side of the interior once the hive interior dropped below 25 degrees. So once the inside is 25 degrees, they don't move. And the study suggests that evidently at and below this temperature, the heat loss from the wooden hive body was greater than the heat absorbed from the sun. So once it gets 25 or lower inside the hive, the bees kind of stay as far away as they can from the outside. So an interesting recording occurred at one point in the study, and it had to do with the shift of movement on one particular occasion where they recorded it. It appears that the bees moved from sideways and down into the center body and then returned to its original location. So they were clustered in the center of the hive. They moved sideways and down. Why would they do that? Apparently, based on the scientists' hypothesis, they were doing this to move to obtain honey. It was a sign that a strong colony can move and then obtain its stores under a lower temperature condition. So the whole ball of wax moved to a different position where there was a honey store, pulled it out, and brought it back to the center, but they did return to the center. So that's a strong colony. It's believed that the opposite holds true. If it's a weak colony, they don't have enough heat to generate to do this kind of movement and maintain the temperature required to move across the different frames and obtain the honey. That's often why you hear that report in the spring that there may be actual honey left in the hive, but the bees starved and froze to death. Sideways movement of the cluster or probable transfer of stores was observed on several occasions during the 5-year study. Okay, it's time for that random Kevin moment. Ever see the movie The Replacements? Think back to the scene where the team moves across the field in the huddle to get away from the unpleasantly deposited by Jumbo in the open plays of the game. I immediately conjure up that scene in my mind while I'm thinking about how the bees get coordinated to move across the frame and get some honey. I know, a mind is a terrible thing to waste. Now back to the regularly scheduled program. If you saw the movie, you totally get it. But anyway, I have musical Tourette's too. I'm sure I've shared that with you. So the 5-year test of the check colony showed that stronger colonies changed cluster location and size more than weaker colonies, and weak clusters could not generate sufficient heat to even move during mild winter temperatures in Wisconsin. So when they preach about having bigger clusters going into the fall season to make sure you have enough bees to generate heat, this is why bees die if you're not following those instructions. So let's talk about population change patterns that they observed. So cluster populations continued to decrease during December and reached a minimum around mid-January. Then they started to increase as brood emerged. The greatest increase took place in April. The volumes of the brood in the unprotected hive was lower than the insulated and heated hive until April. Interesting. In April of each year, it would catch up. More interesting. In the study, the different hives were fed a pollen supplement in early March, as a footnote, and it resulted in more brood being reared, but less so in the unprotected hive. Okay, so they got to March, they gave him some pollen, and the brood started, but the unprotected hive was not going as well as the insulated and heated hive. When the weather warmed up in late March, the unprotected hive colonies increased in numbers much more than the hives with the other conditions. So not only did they catch up, but it appears that they surpassed once they got that population boom. And I talked about the cluster shape, and I guess ask yourself right now, what size is the cluster? We always hear it's about the size of a grapefruit or a small basketball or something like that, but it appears the cluster shape is almost always in the form of an ellipsoid. You can picture flattening a round ball to a flying saucer type shape to understand what an ellipsoid is. The images and diagrams that accompany the report seem to indicate that the ellipsoid is on end, or the vertical in shape, and not flat like a donut laying on a table. Okay, so in summary, some of the data surprises, the thing that I learned is that the hive moves around based on sun radiation. Never contemplated that inside a hive. I always just assumed they'd find a home and stay there. Stronger hive clusters can move to get the honey. Weak ones don't do as well. And so when you get those instructions in the fall about structuring the honey in a certain place, there's a lot of credence to that, right? So that the bees can move around in the cluster. What they said is bees often move sideways, but very rarely move up and down in the wintertime. And when the weather was warmer in late March, the unprotected hive colonies increased in number much more than the hives with the other conditions. So interesting stuff about all that and how the temperature works. Let's talk about the next section of this, is how does a hive box compare to nature? I know a little bit of a deviation, but I'll come back to clusters in a second. So hive boxes have an R value of 1, with 1 being the rating of a thermal conductivity of the material. Contrasted to the recommended R value of home insulation, which is R19 for most of the United States. So R1, not so much. R19 is what you have in your house. The R value of a tree, in contrast, is somewhere between R5 and R15. That plays upon my thoughts about temperature control is probably the one factor that's not wholly addressed in the modern beehive design. So there's a USDA article with the title Stress in Honeybees, and it lends credence to some of my thoughts about maybe we haven't gone as far as we should have with honeybee hive design. So a subsection of that article is germane to the conversation about heat inside the hive, and it has some interesting points about the stresses on the colony. In the subsection Climate, Weather, and the Box Hive, it suggests that domesticated colonies are put in different conditions than the feral bees in nature. Maybe nature ideas are the ones we should be learning from. The insulation of a tree has the factor of living tissue and layers to the outer bark. In between those layers is the cambium. Okay, cambium. A simplified description of the cambium is it's a space where water and nutritional components are carried to the top of the tree. It somewhat thermally stabilizes the tree and can help to cool an internal cavity in the summer and insulate the cavity wall in the winter. And by that insulation, it never freezes, so it's always moving. So it's almost like a water jacket that runs between the bark and the tree compound. If bees don't have access to a tree's nest, they may go in the ground or pick a rock or crevice, and those also have thermal characteristics of the earth that protect the bees better so than the hives that we're putting them in. So studies like that one reviewed show the temperature inside the hive body differs little from the ambient air. I say the one reviewed, the one I just spoke about a few minutes ago. So ambient air temperatures in the United States can fluctuate from negative 30 degrees at one extreme to plus 115 degrees Fahrenheit, and that's a potential for a 145 degree swing. The variability from nature, if you're inside the earth or looking at things inside of a tree, is somewhere about 30 degrees from natural cavities. That's a really big difference, and I'm wondering how we could potentially learn from nature to tap into that. Bees need to maintain a certain humidity in the brood chamber. Say that again, in the brood chamber, and the humidity is produced by the metabolism of honey. It can be said that the heat created by the bees also requires the metabolism of honey, so honey stores are depleted more so in artificial hive spaces like the Langstroth hive. Interesting. So if the temperature didn't fluctuate as much, the bees wouldn't consume as much honey, and they also wouldn't have to manage the humidity as much. The hive requires ventilation to prevent buildup of moisture and ice, and the uninsulated hive has excess moisture, which is the product of the condensation on the uninsulated walls of the hive boxes. The condensation and ventilation draw moisture away from the cluster and work against the cluster, which is trying to maintain a comfort zone of temperature and humidity for the bees. So the bees want to maintain that brood chamber at 92 degrees thereabout, and it needs to have a certain humidity, and the design of the hive is working against that. Okay, so next topic. So how do bees really keep warm, right? We talked about the temperatures, we talked about the shape of the cluster and all that stuff. For the answer to this, I'll review to a 2002 journal publication from the Journal of Experimental Biology. The journal is from issue 206, and it's titled Endothermic Heat Production in Honeybee Winter Clusters. There's an agreement among scientists that the insulation provided by the tightly packed outer bees of the cluster reduces the heat loss drastically. The tighter they get, shoulder to shoulder, that's the right way to say it, on the outer cluster, the better they are at managing the heat within inside. And this is really a decisive factor in the survival of the low temperatures. A different study than the 2002 study was generated in 1995 that suggested that the outer bees would react by moving muscles to generate heat when they get chilled. The 2002 study I'm about to review provides a different conclusion, and that the outer bees do not waste the energy to regulate the temperature. Another way to say this is the scientists believe that the temperature is achieved predominantly by regulation of heat loss through the mantle bees. Remember my analogy of the earth core mantle, the bees on the outside play a huge role in keeping everybody alive. Studies as recently as 1995 indicated that shivering, or better stated, movement of flight muscles is only done when temperatures drop low enough to warm in a cluster. The 2002 study hypothesizes that shivering thermogenesis is at the core of the cluster and found that the outermost bees minimized endothermy. Okay, thermogenesis, endothermy, I'm even struggling saying it, but time for some terminology. Endothermy. So endothermy in this context relates to the heat absorption, or more specifically, the chemical reaction during which there is absorption of heat, kind of like snuggling with your sweetie in a sleeping bag, if you get what I mean. And the endothermy is done at the outside of the hive, right? So they're receiving the heat from the core, or outside of the cluster. They're receiving the heat from the core through body transfer. Thermogenesis is the production of heat, especially in the animal body, by physiological processes. In this case, heat generated by muscle movement. Now think of what's going on in the core of the cluster is like bee aerobics. Strong endothermic bees that remained stationary were found in the core and were not observed on the cluster surface, right? So in the beginning, or up until 1995, or maybe I got this wrong, but at some point it seems the scientists thought that the heat was generated on the outside and going in, and it's really generated on the inside and comes out. It was noted that the endothermic bees came to the surface, and 90% of them re-entered the cluster within 10 seconds to 3 minutes. So, remember what I said before, at 78 degrees, somewhere from the middle of the stack to the outside, it appears that those bees are actually moving the muscles and creating the heat, which is keeping everybody warm. And every once in a while, they pop to the surface. I'm not sure, they're not sure, if it's to keep the other bees warm or to cool off or whatever the case may be. They come out, they could be there for a couple seconds or they could be there for a couple minutes, but they typically turn right in. And I guess I envision, and haven't quite found this in the study, is that the bees are constantly rotating from the inside out as it's their turn to do it, right? So I've always been told that the bees move their wings to generate heat. That's not necessarily true. In fact, it appears they move major muscle groups that permit them to fly, but don't actually have to move the wings unless some reason exists to do so. It was believed that the outermost bees did all the work, but the study concluded that it is the other way around. 15% of the bees on the central comb produce the heat and comfort for themselves and their sisters on the cluster periphery, or the outside. If the honeybee thorax chills to the chill coma temperature of 9 degrees to 11 degrees Celsius, for those in the U.S., that's 48 to 52 degrees Fahrenheit, bees cannot activate their flight muscles and eventually will fall off the cluster. And the study makes assumptions that it would be a waste for the outermost bees to generate the heat as they would lose it to the surrounding area. Lose it to the surrounding area? That seems like a logical conclusion to me. Bees tend to be very efficient. So how do bees stay warm? What did we learn? The inside air of the hive is near the temperature of the outside air. Bees cluster and maintain the heat they need to survive from the inside out. They tighten up the shell on the outside of the oblong cluster to keep the heat in. It gets tighter when the air gets colder. A large, healthy cluster of bees has a better opportunity to use the stores available to them because they can move around on the hive frames. The bees face in. I don't know why I thought that was an interesting fact. As the bees are facing in, and their abdomens are facing out. And the hives that we use are not really as well-suited as one might think. So to that end, let me set up our next segment before we take a short break. I shared with you in our sidebar, episode number 10, that I'm pondering a design for a long hive. A few more weeks poking around on the web, and I found some additional insight into my quest. And a name, kinda, for what it is I want to build. Coming up, the Tanzania Long Hive. We'll be back right after this break. In the last episode, I shared some musings about building a long hive and some ideas about some fancy concepts and a boutique kind of approach or whatever, and I guess I have to put my money where my mouth is, so I started peeking around because now I'm interested in the juices are flowing. You know, we have a local beekeeper in our beekeepers club. His name is Roger Gares, that keeps several hives of differing form factors on a local winery property that's located in the municipality for which I live. Along with some Langstroth hives, Roger maintains a top bar hive, and he added a long hive to his collection this past summer. I must say that I'm envious of Roger's exploits and feel I have a leg up on my quest by knowing someone who's actually employing and learning some of the pitfalls of the different form factors, especially the top bar hive, or TBH as I'll call it, and the long hive. If you joined me for the last episode, you know my desire is to construct a different mousetrap. I don't plan to rush into it, and I'm pretty much just starting the journey toward defining my wants and desires and looking at different methods to meet those needs. While commuting to New York City this past week, I thought about different designs while passing time on the train, and yesterday I had a rare few minutes to go on the web and do some poking around. In the past, I found the beehive design. It originates from the UK, but it's spelled like a German name, B-E-E-H-A-U-S. This design is every much as boutique as what I suggested, and an engineering marvel. If you've not seen the design, it's a plastic hive that is extremely engineered and looks like something that would come out of a Fortune 500 design competition. It used the National Hive design, a different standard than the Langstroth dimensions, and resembles an oversized plastic cooler. Cool, 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 but it doesn't solve the problems that I pondered in my wants and desires. Also, it's made of plastic, which makes me immediately ask questions. Recycling, environment impact, warping, temperature problems, bee acceptance, and so on and so on and so on. I liked the design information provided on the website, though, that showed you how they engineered it. The bee space, the different way the frames set in, the modular part of it, right? And knowing that the internet is a wealth of information, I Googled and binged my way to several dozen websites and designs that range from old 1800s prototypes to modern TBHs and just about everything in between. I think I learned that a TBH, top bar hive, is referred to as a Kenyan top bar hive, presumably because it's a leading design from that country, but I can't confirm or deny that. While the box design with the straight sides that I was thinking about it and the one that I'm more interested in is called a Tanzanian top bar hive. The different characteristic is that the Kenyan has slope sides, Tanzanian, as I said, straight sides. All that aside, did I find anything interesting? My immediate reaction is I liked the Frankenhive. The beehouse design employs a long box covered by smaller boxes across a roof. Think of setting three Langstroth hives side to side, all bound together in one big chamber, and then putting three separate shallow supers on top. The beehouse design is a somewhat modular design, and it appeals to me from that aspect, and the Frankenhive was a similar deal, but made with woodenware, not plastic. Besides, what a cool name, Frankenhive. The Frankenhive is really not that much different than a regular top bar hive, but the website did come with some information provided by its creator that showed different hive configurations that could be employed. You could have three separate brood chambers on the bottom, one big brood chamber, one brood chamber that had two of the sections while the third one hosted a separate colony. You could put colonies up in the top box in the shallow super and have them move their way down. All the different configurations were there. The combinations were pretty fascinating, but still, at the end of the day, it was just a box that you slide frames in just like a Langstroth. I yearned for something more. I was looking at cartridge design, all those things that I mentioned before. What I haven't found too much information on from a design consideration for these form factors is how does air flow, what's the data of air movement, whether you put the entrance at the top, the bottom, the side, the hive entrance methodology, temperature control. Of course, we just spent a lot of time talking about that, so that's obviously something important. I suppose over time these things will expose themselves as I do more research, but for the most part, it just seemed like people were building boxes and sticking bees in them without a lot of science going behind it. I mentioned that the whole thing that got me started on this was Langstroth's book, The Hive and the Honeybee, where he talked about the different aspects of airflow and things like that, and I have to believe that someone out there is considering all these things as they build their hives. So one final note before I move on. I'm focused on that cartridge metaphor that I spoke of concerning frame inspections. To slide the frame in and out, take it off if need be, and slide it back in seems appealing to me. I've been thinking about every type of mice trap that I can get to. I thought about a rod and a tube approach. The rod sticks out and the tube slides over it, kind of like a sleeve. The bees can't propolize that if it's concealed. I thought too about a pin approach, a pin on one end that inserts into a sleeve built into the sidewall, and the top frame sits suspended from the pin. I even considered that the box wouldn't be square, but the box edges could be pulled out, and like an accordion, you could just swing the frames away when you wanted to do it, and then just collapse the whole thing back together when you're ready to fasten it all up. That would prevent you from one of the challenges that I'm trying to solve, which, as I said before, when you pull the frame up out of a Langstroth hive, you tend to roll the bees or squish them when you're trying to get them out, and you have to separate the hives, but always when you pull that first one out, you're in danger of squishing the queen or doing something bad there. So I found a picture on a website about the history of beekeeping, and it showed a design from the 1800s that had a frame with a hinge on it. It was cool. The shape of the frame or the insert was a triangle, and on one corner it had a hinge and allowed you to reach across in front of you and pull that triangle that was facing point down over, and it was facing point up on the hinge when it came back. Pretty clever, I thought. And it got me to thinking that I'm wondering if there's a place in this world to see all the better mousetraps that people tried. I think that would be a fascinating pursuit. And to that end, I found a website that talked about a bee museum. And I actually found some pictures of these old hives that people tried. Most of them don't have what I'm looking for, but I have to believe that there's some answer out there that could potentially lead some clues into how to do this. So that's a little follow-up on the hive design. And now what I know is what I'm searching for is a Tanzanian top bar hive. It's a box with square sides, similar to a horizontal Langstroth. One final footnote to that. The bee house plastic hive that I found, the U.S. website, still looked like it used the European standard for hive frame shapes. And I mentioned that the Langstroth, the frames are rectangular in shape, and they're more horizontal than vertical. And it appears the bees would like a chain rope shape, taller than wider. And the national standard that's in that bee house tends to have this shape. So I'm wondering if I could leverage those frames in my new hive. You know, you got to think about all the options. All right. That's enough on that. We'll, I guess, follow up on that as news comes through. But an interesting quest. If you have any thoughts, any comments about that, send me a note, Kevin@BK Corner. If you know of some interesting hive designs or you're working on a long hive yourself, I found a website with a guy who built his own. And he's been doing that since August time frame, and I'm following him too. So it's kind of like a Roger, but on the web. And I guess there's a lot of interest in this. I don't know if it's just because I'm discovering it now that I'm looking, or I see a lot of people doing it, but the common denominator that I continually find is that people with back problems and people who are just sick of lugging around gear seem to find this top bar hive and the Tanzania hive shape a little more amenable to that. So maybe I'm onto something here. Don't know. All right. One more short break, and then we'll get back to mite dusting with powdered sugar. Is it really a valuable varroa control? We're going to find out in just a second. Welcome back to BK Corner. Thanks for hanging around. I mentioned in a not-so-distant episode that there were some misgivings about the effectiveness of varroa mite control via the powdered sugar method. You know, while surfing the web the other day, I came across a free preview copy of the American Bee Journal that's available on the web. I don't subscribe to this publication, and I was curious to preview it, so I took a look. The journal looks interesting enough, and I might have to consider if it's worth the addition to my shelf. And if I have enough time to read it, I might just do that. But all that aside, one article in the journal piqued my interest. Piqued, whatever the word is. There was a running series in there about how effective powdered sugar was for controlling the varroa. The study within cited mite counts after applying sugar to hives, and I thought I'd share some of the findings. So we just had this conversation amongst our beekeepers in our club about whether people really like this, and the common consensus was they just didn't particularly like the idea, but this study seems to prove that might be something that people should really be considering continuing. So let's talk about it. First off, they use one cup of sugar for each box on a two-box configuration. I share that it's one cup of sugar because there's this age-old debate about how much sugar you use when you dust them, and they used a full cup. They powdered the bees and counted them in 10-minute, 30-minute, 1-hour, 2-hour, 3-hour, 21-hour, 24-hour, and 33-hour intervals. So 10-minute, 30-minute, 1, 2, 3, 21, 24, 33-hour intervals. That's a lot of counting, but it's an interesting result. So here's the findings. If you counted mites that fell off with no treatment and contrasted that with a hive that had a sugar fall off, you would find that more mites fall off than the normal fall off rate after sugaring for a period of 24 hours, for around 24 hours. So what's that mean? On a normal hive, the mites fall off the bees. The bees clean them off, or they just drop off, or whatever. You can count the number of mites falling, and they did that. What they found is that when they sugared them, more mites fell off than just run-of-the-mill falling off. What they found is that is true when they sugared them for a 24-hour period. After 24 hours, they returned to normal. So sugar was dusted on two deep hives, and also on a single hive deep configuration. And I'll get to why they did that in a second. So the drop rate for one deep hive, meaning one box, was 6.3 times the normal rate. So because they sugared them in a 24-hour period, they had 6.3 more mites falling off. Not the right way to say that, but I think you understand what I mean. The drop rate on a 1 deep hive was more consistent with 2 deep hives. So why? 2 deep hives may be impacted by the fact that the sugar could be trapped due to the frames not lining up correctly. So if you dust the top frames and what falls between lands on the top frame below and not necessarily on the bees in the bottom box, then it's not going to work as well. So the drop rate of mites for two deep hives was 5 times the rate of hives with no treatment. So the rate of drops. Just because you sugar the bees doesn't mean they all fall off right to begin with. What they found is 50% of the mites fall within the first 10 minutes. 80% fall within the first hour. So after you sugar the bees, within 10 minutes, half the mites that are going to fall off. And then within the first hour, you have 80%. And then presumably for the remaining 23 hours, the remaining 20% fall off. What does that tell me? 6.3% better drop-off rate, or 6.3 times the normal rate by sugaring, it means sugar works. Why wouldn't we do it? It's an integrated pest management. It's not drugs. It's not chemicals. It's sugar. The other thing that they found out, as an aside, and we're going to do some more follow-up, unfortunately, in the next episode or the next issue, which I didn't have access to, is the secondary conclusion was that counting mites dropped from sugar dusting was as accurate a predictor of mite loads as performing the more espoused method, which is an alcohol wash method. I covered that in one of the episodes, how to do the sugar shake. And then the alcohol is, if you scoop out a certain amount of bees and you roll them in alcohol, which kills the bees, you can get a very accurate count. And what they found is when they compared the counts after doing the sugaring method and the alcohol method, they found that they were pretty even. And you didn't have to kill the bees. They were going to do some further study, and I can't say that I know the conclusion, but seemed pretty convinced at the outset of this. So, hey, dusting with mites, or dusting mites with powdered sugar, is a good idea, and it's a form of integrated pest management. And it's certainly a reasonable alternative if it doesn't involve chemicals. And this study convinces me that its effectiveness is real. And that's good news, and I'm going to go back and share that with my club. All right. Heard a lot of research went on the last couple days. So I shared recently that I'm a closet foodie. And like so many other people these days, and given that I'm attuned to that interest, foodie topics come up in the strangest places. And researching how bees behave in the winter, my ADHD mind found a book recommendation from 1911, Dr. C.C. Miller, 50 Years Among the Bees. There was a reference in there about the temperature control of beehives, and it ended up as a dead end, but I pursued the book anyway. And I found it in PDF form, because it's old, I guess it's in the public domain. And at the bottom of the PDF was a list of honey recipes. Okay, recipes of that time frame, in the 1900s, late 1800s, 1900s, are an interesting lot. They resembled nothing like the format we know and see today. So I pulled a sample recipe for a soft honey cake that I want to share with you. Mrs. Minnick's soft honey cake. Not too complicated. Put a scant teaspoon of soda, I'm assuming they mean baking soda, in a teacup. Pour 5 tablespoons of hot water on the soda. Then fill the cup with extracted honey. Take a half cup of butter and 1 egg and beat together. Add 2 cups of flour, 1 teaspoonful of ginger. Stir all together and bake in a very slow oven. That's it. That's all you get. I always thought it was interesting when you read these old recipes, there's really not a direction. Like, how hot? There is no hot. You put it in a slow oven. When I look at this recipe, I think 1 teaspoonful of ginger is a lot of ginger. I don't know. So I went back and I looked, and I found there's another recipe in there for soft honey cake, similar but different. So this one reads, soft honey cake, 1 cup butter, 2 cups honey, 2 eggs, 1 cup sour milk, 2 teaspoonfuls of soda, 1 teaspoonful of ginger, 1 teaspoonful of cinnamon, 4 cups flour. So proportionally, it sounds like a more sound recipe, and maybe I need to get some buttermilk, because I think I have everything else. Doesn't instruct you how to cook it, doesn't tell you how long, doesn't tell you what temperature. You just mix it all together and cook it, I guess. I would think, like the other one, you're just going to bake it in a very slow oven. If I can convince my honey to buy some buttermilk to replace the sour milk. I guess you can make sour milk by mixing lemon juice and regular milk, but I think I'll go the real deal and get some buttermilk and try it out. Proportionally, it seems like a sound recipe. Cup of butter, which will give it brownness and add a little flavor. 2 cups of honey, hygroscopic. 2 eggs, that'll give it structure. Also bring a little moisture to it. A cup of sour milk and the soda. 2 of them will counteract each other. And the sour milk will give a little complement to the honey. 1 teaspoonful of ginger and cinnamon to give it a little flavor. And that's a pretty good merge to 4 cups of flour. I'm going to have to try that one. That looks really interesting. And the ADHD part of this is that wasn't looking for a recipe, but happened to find one. And I've heard this in the past, that people find some of the most interesting things when they're not looking for them. So soft honey cake, going to have to try that out. I'll let you know. I spoke just a moment ago about serendipity, and sometimes the most complicated problems to rationalize have simple answers. The aforementioned book, 50 Years Among the Bees, had this little nugget in it, something that has perplexed me for a long time. Unless care is taken, bees will be killed when a super, which has just been taken off, is put back again. Sometimes there may be so few bees in the way that the super can be put on quickly without danger. Oftener, too many bees are in the way for you to do this, so I put one end on its place, and with a series of rapid up and down motions, gradually lower the other end to its place. This gives the bees time to get out of the way, and there are seldom, if any, crushed by it. That word of wisdom comes from the book 50 Years Among the Bees, and I guess it's only because I've only spent 3 years amongst the bees that I haven't figured that out yet, but it is something that just the other day at our beekeepers' final winter meeting, I was mentioning to somebody that it really bothers me when I put the hive boxes down that I crush bees sometimes, and that's brilliant. I can't wait for the spring to come to try it out. I can't say that I'm 100% convinced that it's going to work, and time will tell, but it's certainly one of those problems that I have on my catalog of things to consider for a new hive design. Aside time again, is oftener a word? Thanks to CC Miller, nonetheless, for taking the time to record all that stuff. There's some amazing information, and I really recommend if you have a chance to go take a look at that. Again, we'll have it in the show notes. Maybe someday someone will be offering commentary on my words of wisdom. Won't that be an interesting twist of events? Well, that's all there is for this episode. It's hard to believe we've come to the end already. I'm not sure how soon it will be before another episode turns a corner, but I have at least a half dozen topics in the queue, so we'll continue to bring you some content here in the off-season. I have some pet projects to roll out over the break for beekeeping and soccer, namely an updated website for the Beekeepers Association and a prototype for a scout website is also possibly in the cards. I guess they say no rest for the weary. I know this is the time when I typically share the names and recordings of the podcast safe music that we use for the episode. I mean no disrespect to those who have been gracious enough to share, but I'm going to discontinue the practice starting with this episode. In lieu of the mention, please be sure to check out our show notes at www.bkcorner.org. If you want to know who's on the docket, we'll try to provide links back to that music so you can download it if you're interested. Last but not least, I wanted to take a moment to say hi and thanks to a couple of listeners for writing in. Gary Standin, thanks for the notes on the Varroa treatments and the link information for the oxalic acid data. Very interesting stuff you provided. And a quick shout out to Scotty Brightback, who shared some information about our first episode. If you have something to share, send me a note at kevin@bkcorner.org. Until we meet again, keep that hive tool at hand, and thanks for listening. We'll catch you next time on the Beekeeper's Corner.
Plains of North Dakota to the dry desert sand. If there's anywhere I've been there, hey, what do you expect from a lonesome weary man? So I keep on rolling as long as there's a road. Driving on and missing you. Oh. Oh. car traveling down a gravel road, kicking up dust along the way. I'm behind the wheel on this lonely road, trying to get you out of my brain.